Hello, welcome to Antiquitas, Leaders and Legends of the Ancient World, with Cornell University professor Barry Strauss, military historian, expert in the ancient world, and best-selling author. During this podcast, Barry and his guests will share stories about fascinating and controversial people and events in history and myth. And now, Professor Barry Strauss.
You couldn't miss the king. The battle was already a muddle of men and horses in motion, and yet he was unmistakable. He was short but muscular, and he sat on a huge black steed, shining in his splendid armor with tall white plumes fixed on either side of his helmet. Alexander, king of Macedon, led the second wave of the companion cavalry. A blast of bugles and a roar of battle cries had sent them off, galloping across the shallow Granicus River and up onto the opposite bank under the waiting eyes of Persia's finest horsemen. Flushed with victory over the first wave of the Macedonian attack, the Persians charged the enemy with loud shouts. Two Persian brothers zeroed in on Alexander himself. Rosaces and Spithridates were both aristocrats. Spithridates was governor of Ionia, a wealthy province on what is today Turkey's Aegean coast. The brothers charged, and Spithridates split Alexander's helmet with his scimitar and grazed his hair. Alexander struck back and drove his wooden lance into Spithridates' chest. As Spithridates died, his brother swung his sword at Alexander's naked head and aimed a death blow. In the split second before he made contact, his arm was sliced off by the deft sword of Clytus the Black, a Macedonian officer. Alexander was saved. It was a May Day in what is now northwestern Turkey in 334 BC. Welcome back to Antiquitas. In case you had any doubts, you are here, and we are turning the page ahead about 150 years from Xerxes' invasion of Greece in 480 BC and the battles of Thermopylae and Salamis. We've now gone ahead to 334 BC, as I just said, and this is another clash between Greeks and Persians, or rather between Greek speakers and Persians, because as we'll see, the Macedonians took the lead. It is the famous invasion of the Persian Empire by King Alexander of Macedon, who we know today as Alexander the Great. What we want to talk about is the first clash between the two of them, the first clash between Alexander and the Persian army that he wanted to defeat. It took place in a little stream in northwestern Turkey called the Granicus River. The Battle of the Granicus was an absolutely crucial test. At the time, Alexander was a young king, just under 22, and he was still in need to prove himself. It was a duel between Alexander and his most dangerous enemy, who actually wasn't a Persian. He was a Greek mercenary in Persia's service. Alexander became king of Macedon in 336 BC, when his father, Philip II, was assassinated. Philip was a genius who had turned Macedon from a weak border state into the leading power of the Greek world. In a lightning career of two decades on the throne, Philip had united the squabbling tribes of Macedon, created a new, innovative, and more powerful army, conquered his neighbors, and then, eventually, conquered all the leading city-states of Greece. He united them into a league under his command. And what he wanted to do next was even bolder. He planned to turn on the Persian Empire and to conquer that. Now, in Philip's day, it was about 150 years since Xerxes' invasion of Greece. During those years, the Persian Empire had suffered numerous internal revolts, and it had never again added new territory, and yet it had survived more or less intact. In fact, not only had it survived, but it had successfully intervened from time to time in the wars of the Greek city-states, and it had sometimes come out on top, occasionally serving as what we might think of as the umpire of Greece, ordering around the different city-states and their relations with each other. As for those Greek city-states, they had seen a shifting series of hegemonies, a kaleidoscope of rulers and leading states. First Athens, then Sparta, then Thebes, and then a period of a power vacuum. The net result over the 150 years was to weaken Greece and to leave a gap, which the rising power of Macedon filled. Unlike the city-states, Macedon was a monarchy, and Philip proved to be a strong and efficient ruler. Now, who were the Macedonians? In the 4th century BC, the Macedonians were a separate ethnicity, but they were related to the Greeks who lived in the city-states. They spoke a similar language and worshipped the same gods. The ruling elite, like Philip and Alexander, were all educated in Greek culture and spoke perfect Greek. Alexander was born to fight this war. Like his father, he had the personality of a conqueror, with a passionate conviction of his destiny and ability, and even of his divinity. Philip had hinted in public that the 12 Olympian gods should add him to their ranks. Alexander simply proclaimed himself a god. Alexander believed that he was descended from the mythical Greek hero Achilles. From childhood on, Alexander identified with Achilles. Branding himself as a second Achilles was a two-edged sword, though. Not only was Achilles Greece's greatest warrior, but he was also its most selfish. Compared to his own honor, he cared little for his country. He chose glory over long life. Achilles loved war and had little interest in hearth and home. For Alexander, the parallels would prove all too fitting. Alexander certainly had a knack for war. His courage, his bravery, and his ambition stood out even in his adolescence. Even before Philip's death, Alexander showed himself to be a great cavalry commander and a great leader of men. Alexander's father survived decades on the notoriously unstable throne of Macedon by devoting nearly the whole time to war. His successful expansion abroad underwrote his popularity at home, but in the end, he was assassinated. Philip's last military act had been to start the long-planned invasion of Persian Anatolia by sending advanced forces. One other thing. Philip had spent practically everything in the Macedonian treasury to pay for his military force. By the time Alexander invaded Persia, Macedon, the richest kingdom in Europe, was broke. Alexander had to fight his way to solvency or face ruin. Alexander's march into the Persian Empire was not merely an invasion route, but a form of information warfare aimed at two audiences, the Persian army and Greek public opinion. His message to Persia was, he was coming and in force. For 2 years, the Macedonian army in what is now Turkey had consisted of a 10,000-man advance force. Now in 334, nearly 50,000 Macedonians had invaded, along with a fleet of 160 warships and numerous transports. To the Greeks, Alexander presented his expedition as revenge. He marked it as a pan-Hellenic crusade, an all-Greek crusade, to avenge the Persians' invasion of 480 BC. That was 150 years ago, a long time in the past. But most Greeks still thought of the Persians as, quote, the barbarian, as their ancestors had. But Alexander had a problem. He was faced with a threat of rebellion in his Greek rear, and this included the unreliable Athenian navy. His main navy consisted of Athenian ships. Alexander had to show that he was pro-Greek and that any Greeks who supported Persia would be dealt with brutally. He did that by a combination of propaganda gestures and brutal reprisals. In order to emphasize the theme of Greek revenge, Alexander led the Macedonian army eastward toward the Hellespont on about the same route that Xerxes had followed when he had marched westward in his doomed invasion of Greece in 480. Alexander crossed the Hellespont in the very place where Xerxes had bridged the channel. Xerxes built the bridge, Alexander crossed it by ship. While he was crossing, Alexander made sacrifices to the gods and poured a libation into the water. When he landed on the Asian shore, Alexander strode onto the beach in full armor. He then threw a spear. It was a dramatic gesture, a sign, as he later put it, that he considered the Persian Empire as, quote, spear one land, land that the gods would give him if he could indeed conquer it. For good measure, Alexander went to the nearby city of Troy, or rather Ilion, the Greek city built on the site of Troy. Xerxes had made a similar pilgrimage there in 480, and Alexander could do no less. Having waged a propaganda campaign to demonstrate his devotion to the cause of Greece, Alexander now returned to the main purpose of his trip to what is today Turkey. He rejoined his army. Alexander invaded the Persian Empire in 334 BC with a clear war plan, but an open-ended goal. At a minimum, he wanted to conquer Western Turkey and add it to his kingdom. At a maximum, well, there's reason to think that Philip had aimed at conquering the entire Persian Empire in all of its vastness. This included both Persia's other holdings in Western Asia, Syria, Palestine, and Mesopotamia, as well as in Africa, Egypt, and lands lying further eastward, the Iranian plateau and all or part of modern Kazakhstan, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Pakistan, and northwestern India. It was a huge ambition, and to some, it would probably have seemed like science fiction, or maybe a horror movie, considering the strains it would have put on Macedonian manpower and morale. No one could rule an empire this big without becoming an absolute monarch. Alexander's advisors knew this, and many of them eventually recoiled in horror from the prospect. But it probably seemed far off at first, since the Persian Empire was no pushover. Persia still had huge advantages in money, manpower, ships, and local knowledge. Each step in his campaign was a tall order. Let's take what is today Turkey. To conquer it, Alexander had to keep the Persian navy from opening a second front in Greece, as well as defeat the Persian army in Turkey. He also had to win allies and find food for his men. Finally, he had to raise money because war is expensive and his treasury was empty. In 334, Alexander was only 22 years old and he had sat on the throne for only 2 years. Yet he was already an experienced commander. At age 16, Philip had made him regent of Macedonia, and Alexander led a rapid expedition to Thrace that put down a rebellion and turned their city into a Macedonian military outpost that he called Alexandropolis, literally Alexander City. Then at age 18, under Philip's supervision, Alexander led the Macedonian cavalry on the war-winning charge that conquered Greece at the Battle of Chaeronea. That took place in 338 BC in central Greece. At 20, Alexander became king. In the next 2 years, as commander-in-chief of the Macedonian army, Alexander marched his armies 1,000 miles, suppressed rebellions in Greece and the Balkans, and he destroyed Thebes, Greece's single most powerful land power. He also extended his empire's northern frontier to the Danube River, won a series of victories on his own without the help of Philip's best generals, and executed both precisely planned operations and brilliant improvisations. Alexander demonstrated other skills as well, such as his mastery of combined arms operations, in which he used cavalry, light-armed, and heavy-armed infantry. He showed himself able to scramble when needed by sizing up both enemy and terrain on the spot and issuing precisely the right orders. He was very inventive. On one occasion, he had his men cut steps up the cliff face of a mountain, and on another occasion, he ordered them to throw together a scratch fleet to cross the Danube. The most creative thing of all was that Alexander was history's first recorded use of field artillery. Alexander had the love of his soldiers, and he had earned it. But he had also earned the fear of Macedon's Greek and Balkan allies. Yet he didn't trust those allies. Nowadays, Macedonia is an integral part of Greece. But in Alexander's era, many Greeks looked on Macedonians as savages. Many Greeks would have been glad to revolt, given a chance. The Persian navy represented that chance. To discourage them, Alexander left 13,500 soldiers. That's practically a quarter of his total forces. He left these soldiers behind in Macedonia when he invaded Persia. Their job was to be ready to put down any Greek city-state that joined the Persians, should the Persians send their fleet across the Aegean to the Greek rear. Every major Greek city-state on the Greek mainland except Sparta had joined Alexander's coalition, Sparta stubbornly held out. Its great days were behind it, however, and it was now mainly a small and out-of-the-way place with a glorious name. Even if its refusal smarted, Sparta was not worth the trouble to conquer. Alexander also planned a political response to the threatened Persian naval offensive. As he drove the Persians out of the Greek cities of Anatolia, he advertised himself as a liberator for all Greeks, but he also showed himself to be a killer of Greeks, as we shall see. Let's rejoin this brilliant, energetic, violent commander in the first campaign of his war on Persia. Things could hardly have gone better for Alexander as his army invaded Turkey in spring 334. Getting from Europe to Asia required ferrying across the narrow waterway of the Hellespont. A strategic bottleneck, the Hellespont attracted antiquity's naval battles the way a canvas ring attracts boxers. But Persia's mighty fleet was nowhere to be seen. Why? Well, here's the reason. The Macedonians controlled both shores at the crossing point, and ancient navies did not like to fight without a friendly shore to retreat to. Alexander's forces crossed unmolested and landed near Troy. He had a large army, about 37,000 fighting men, 32,000 infantrymen, and 5,000 cavalry. If we add to them the Macedonian advance force that was already in Turkey, they totaled about 50,000 men. Their logistical base, however, was made of sand. Alexander had only a month's worth of supplies. Worse still, he had no money. Macedon had spent its last drachma in putting together the invasion force. To feed his men, Alexander would have to persuade or force the cities of Anatolia to open their gates and their granaries. The great king of Persia at the time was Darius III. Like Alexander, he was a warrior and a recent occupant of his throne. Darius hadn't inherited his rule from his father, rather he had fought his way to the top. Darius did not take the Macedonian threat lightly. He saw to it that the five governors of Turkey's great provinces met and pooled their military resources. These governors were called satraps, and they were working under the guidance of the leading mercenary general of the day. In retrospect, Darius made a mistake by allowing a divided command when he should have enforced a single united policy. Committees do not make good generals. As Alexander's army arrived on the soil of Asia, a council of Persian commanders met about 75 miles to the east in the small city of Zelia. Those present included satraps and members of the royal family, as well as the greatest mercenary commander of the age, Memnon of Rhodes, I'm quoting the ancient sources, a man famous for his good judgment as a general. Memnon was Greek. It might seem surprising to find a Greek among Persia's commanders, but it was a common sight. Persians made great cavalrymen, but only mediocre infantrymen. And Greeks made excellent infantrymen. When it came to war, the Persian government was pragmatic and relatively open-minded, so it hired Greek soldiers and Greek generals. Memnon came from the premier mercenary family of the era. He and his brother had spent 20 years in Persian service where they rose to top positions. They had married into, let's face it, Persia's first family of rebellion, the family of the satrap of Phrygia, which is an important area in northwestern Turkey. Memnon's brother had married the satrap's daughter, Barsini. But that brother died in 340 BC, and Barsini, the widow, now married her former brother-in-law, Memnon. Then there is this problem. Earlier, Barsini's father, the satrap, had rebelled against the Persian king at the time. And Memnon and his brother had found themselves having to flee. Memnon went to Macedon and the court of Philip II. His brother went to Egypt and eventually ended up back in the good graces of the Persian Empire by helping to put down a rebellion there. So in exchange, Memnon and his father-in-law were pardoned and allowed to return to Persian territory. When they came back, they had firsthand knowledge of Macedon and its plans and its power. So when Darius III became king of Persia in 336 BC, he was very happy to have Memnon serve him loyally. Memnon leveraged his knowledge of Macedon into a series of victories against Alexander's advance forces in Turkey in 336 and 335. In one battle, Memnon even defeated the Macedonian commanding general, the great veteran Parmenio, and he drove him back towards the Hellespont. But Memnon was a shrewd customer, and he did not overestimate his success. He knew that it was one thing to defeat a small advance force, and quite another to take on the main army led by its king. Memnon knew just how seasoned and ruthless young Alexander was. Memnon concluded that a conventional battle against Macedon was simply too dangerous because of the Persians' inferiority in infantry. Instead, and I'm going to quote the ancients again, instead Memnon, quote, advocated a policy of stripping the countryside and through the shortage of supplies, preventing the Macedonians from advancing further. This was, in fact, a scorched earth policy. At the same time, Memnon was pressing for a naval offensive. So remember, the Persian satraps with Memnon were gathered around 75 miles away from Alexander. They're gathered at a place called Zelea, and there they rejected Memnon's advice. They considered it their duty to defend their land, not to destroy it. And they might have disliked taking advice from a foreigner like Memnon. Some might have even questioned his loyalty. Considering that the Macedonians had spared Memnon's estates near Troy from ravaging, this was probably a bit of psychological warfare aimed at making the Persians distrust Memnon. So the Persian high command at Zelea decided to fight a pitched battle. They knew that Alexander outnumbered them in infantry, but they probably also knew that most of Alexander's 30,000 infantrymen were untested and untrustworthy allied troops. Persia had 6,000 veterans. They were reliable Greek mercenaries. When it came to cavalry, Persia had the numerical edge. They had 20,000 cavalrymen. Alexander only had 5,000. And so the Persians planned to take advantage of this and make their fight into a cavalry battle. And they knew that they could fight on ground of their own choosing. They knew that Alexander would have to come to them. As long as the Persians had an army near Zelea, Alexander could not march south, because the enemy might then cut his communications with the Hellespont. So Alexander marched toward Zelea about 3 days away from Troy. As the enemy might have guessed, he left most of his 30,000 infantrymen behind. He took only 12,000 heavy infantrymen, all trusted Macedonians, as well as 1,000 light-armed troops from Thrace, that's modern Bulgaria. He also brought his entire cavalry, 5,000 men. The Persian army was waiting for him. The Persians made their stand on the main east-west road, west of Zelea. As Alexander's army marched eastward, his scouts reported the location of the Persians at the far end of the plain of Adrastia on the east bank of the Granicus River. The defenders had chosen good ground. The river was not deep. In May, it was only about 3 feet. Yet it was fast-flowing, slippery, and protected by steep and muddy banks. The Macedonians would have no easy time getting their men across and in good order. The Persians planned to take advantage of disarray in the enemy ranks to execute a strategy of decapitation. They would target Alexander and kill him. They almost succeeded. I had the chance to visit the site of the Battle of the Granicus River, or rather its general location, as we can't pinpoint where the battle took place. It was about 10 years ago, and I was lucky enough to travel with my friend Serhan Güngör. Serhan is Turkey's super guide, by the way. There's no better companion for a tour of Istanbul or anywhere else in Turkey. You can find him at the web at serhangungur.com. That's S-E-R-H-A-N as in November, G-U-N as in November, G-O-R.com. Anyhow, Serhan and I followed Alexander's footsteps in an unforgettable tour from the Hellespont to Antioch, a distance of roughly 1,900 miles. The Granicus River was one of our first stops. It's the modern-day Bigachay, or Biga River, in northwestern Turkey, roughly about 75 miles northeast of the site of Troy. The Biga is located in a valley in very fertile farm country, and when we saw it in June, it was green and lush. Storks were feeding their storklings in the nests atop telephone poles. With very few people around, it wasn't difficult to imagine the area in ancient times. Although the peacefulness of the countryside made it hard to think of the river running red with blood, as it surely did at the time of the battle. The river looked gentle when we saw it. It flowed slowly and even seemed stagnant. But we saw it in June, and the flow would be more rapid in May, the month when the battle was fought. Also, keep in mind that nowadays, water is drawn from the river for irrigation. Since this was not the case in ancient times, the river probably flowed more swiftly then, just as the ancient sources say. Although the banks of the river were generally low, we saw certain points where they were indeed quite steep, as the sources say they were. In short, the Biga River today roughly fits the description in the ancient sources of the Granicus River, and visiting the Biga is very evocative for anyone interested in the battle between Alexander and the Persian army that took place on the banks of the Granicus River in May 334 BC. Let's return to the narrative events. It was already afternoon when the Macedonians located the Persians. Alexander's advisors recommended delaying until the next day in the hope that the enemy would withdraw from the damp river edge overnight, which would allow the Macedonians to cross in the morning. Alexander himself insisted on immediate battle. Usually a good psychologist, he knew that action would inspire his men and frighten the enemy. The Persian cavalry lined the east bank of the Granicus, covering both the lip of the bank and a flat area going back about 300 yards. They held their infantry, all Greek mercenaries, in reserve on the high ground behind them, knowing it would be pointless to deploy them against an enemy who outnumbered them. The infantry could be called in later if needed. On the other side of the river, Alexander's Macedonians did not follow suit, but arranged their infantry between their cavalry on either wing. Alexander and the Macedonian cavalry held the Macedonian right wing. Parmenio, that veteran general, and the allied Thessalian cavalry occupied the left wing. The Thessalians came from central Greece. As usual, the cavalry would strike first. They could not make a frontal assault, but their scouts had found a few gentle gravel slopes along the steep banks of the river. The cavalry aimed for those places as crossing places. And so, with the two waves of riders, the two waves with which our podcast started, these two waves attacked the Persians. Alexander began with a shrewd move. He sent in a squadron of about 1,000 cavalrymen to draw the enemy off the bank and into the river. It succeeded, but at a cost of heavy Macedonian casualties. Having forced the enemy to break up its line, Alexander now attacked. He led his men in oblique order heading upstream, that is, going further to his right, in order to do two things. First, Alexander wanted to outflank the Persians, and then he wanted to ensure that his men would present a solid front to the enemy, rather than emerge from the river in column, where they could be picked off one by one. No novice, he'd proven himself 4 years earlier by leading a cavalry charge against the Greeks at the Battle of Chaeronea. But the Persians were no novices either. A wedge-shaped unit of horsemen, led by some of Persia's leading men, bore down on the enemy. They aimed for Alexander, hoping to cut out the heart of the invasion by killing its leader. And they almost succeeded. In fact, they would have changed history had not Clytus saved his king from Arsaces' nearly fatal attack, as we heard earlier. Once the Macedonians rescued Alexander, their assault proved devastating to the Persians. For all the elegance of Alexander's opening moves, Granicus came down to a brawl. The sources talk of shoving and, quote, of horses fighting entangled with horses and men entangled with men. Alexander's men had better equipment and technical expertise, and many of them, especially his bodyguard, were just plain big and strong. The Macedonians had Cornel wood lances, heavy, thrusting weapons that greatly outperformed the Persians' light javelins, which were throwing weapons. A 12-foot-long lance with the weight of a galloping horse and rider behind it could crush a skull. And the Macedonians aimed at the faces of the Persians and their horses. While Macedonian horsemen pushed the Persians back, Thracian light troops, who intermingled with the cavalry, added to the Persians' woes. They were specialists at darting in and out of horsemen and hurling their javelins. I'm now going to quote from an article by John Ma discussing skeletons found in a mass grave of elite Greek soldiers killed in a battle with the Macedonians in central Greece in 338 BC. They were killed at the Battle of Chaeronea, which I've referred to several times earlier. The skeletons were infantrymen, but they were attacked by Macedonian cavalry. So their condition is relevant to the case of the Granicus River. I'm going to quote, these are skeletons again. These are ancient skeletons found in a mass grave. And these were elite Greek soldiers who died in 338 BC, so 4 years before the Granicus River, and they were killed by Macedonians. And here's what Professor Ma has to say. This material offers shockingly direct evidence for the face of battle. The bones show many traces of circa mortem trauma. Shin bones exhibit multiple cut marks, a type of wound paralleled in the skeletons from a medieval mass grave in England, and reflecting close-range combat with edged weapons. Several skulls bear marks of multiple sword blows. The phenomenon of blows to the head is well paralleled, notably in the medieval evidence. One man received a powerful cut from aft to fore, followed by a death blow to the rear part of the top of the head on the left side, probably from a butt spike, used notably by the Macedonians. This blow produced a small hole where the spike punctured the skull, surrounded by a wider circular mark and radiating cracks, in other words, a depressed fracture resulting from the impact of the flaring ring or flange above the spike. In one particularly horrendous case, a blow, perhaps delivered from the man's left, sliced from temple to temple across the top of the forehead, shearing off the face. This is compatible with a cavalryman fighting against an infantryman, driving past him in a melee, and hacking down backhanded. Such blows are recorded during the charge of the British heavy cavalry at Waterloo. Well, that was a little clinical and very violent, so pardon me if that bothered you, but I wanted to give you a sense of what the reality of this battle was for the men fighting it. So the Macedonian cavalry defeated their Persian counterparts. Meanwhile, in the center of the line, the Macedonian infantry advanced. With terrifying efficiency and with their huge pikes held out before them, the men of the phalanx crossed the river, climbed the opposite bank, and forced the enemy back. The Persian center broke, and the cavalry turned and fled. On the Macedonian left, the central Greek cavalry fought with distinction. As for Persia's Greek mercenaries, they stood in the rear, amazed and horrified at what was happening. Apparently, no one had ordered them into action. Alexander and his men won a great victory. It was a tribute to the Macedonian army's professionalism and its power, and it reflected well on Alexander's boldness as a field commander and courage as a warrior. But it also left an opening to the Persians, who had, after all, nearly killed their enemy's king. The Persians had access to huge manpower resources. If they mustered a big enough army with plenty of Greek mercenaries and enough cavalry to surround the Macedonians on the wings, then they stood a chance in winning a battle. Except for the squadron of 1,000 cavalrymen, Macedonian casualties were light, although probably not as light as the pro-Macedonian sources make them. Supposedly, just 85 cavalry and 30 infantrymen died. Macedonian casualty figures would go up in the battles ahead, but all in all, they stayed fairly low. That was one key to Alexander's success. He spared his men. He also lavished kindness on them. After the battle, Alexander made sure his wounded were treated well, and he went to the trouble of visiting each of them himself. He had the Macedonian dead buried with their weapons. He exempted their surviving families from taxes. Finally, he commissioned a bronze statue group in honor of the 25 Macedonian companion cavalry, the elite knights who fell in the first attack. Alexander gave the job to the most famous sculptor of the day, and he had the statues erected in Macedonia. Now, what about the Persians? Their casualties were high. About 1,000 Persian cavalrymen were killed. 8 Persian generals fell in the battle, including 2 satraps, the commander of the mercenaries, and 2 royal in-laws and a former king's grandson. Another satrap escaped and committed suicide soon afterwards. Memnon of Rhodes, the Greek mercenary general, he escaped as well, but he planned to keep up the fight. What about the 6,000 Greek mercenaries? Well, I'm afraid they fared much worse. Because the fighting was all but over, the Greeks expected to be able to surrender. Instead, the Macedonians surrounded them and attacked. The Greeks defended themselves, and the Macedonians took casualties. But in the end, it was a massacre. Only 2,000 Greeks survived, and they were sent to Macedon to do hard labor. Even by ancient standards, this was brutal. If your enemy surrendered, you were supposed to accept the surrender. But the point was not military, but political. Alexander wanted to brand any Greek who opposed him as a traitor. This message was aimed not only at Greeks in Persian service, but also at potential rebels on the Greek home front. To underline the message, Alexander sent 300 captured Persian suits of armor to the Parthenon, the temple of Athena the Maiden on the Acropolis in Athens, with the inscription, quote, "Alexander, son of Philip, and the Greeks except the Spartans," from the barbarians living in Asia. In Greek terms, the inscription meant that Alexander was fighting for all Greece in a clash of enemies against a supposedly savage enemy living in another continent. For all Greeks, that is, except the Spartans. This was a subtle dig. Or maybe not so subtle. In the old days, Sparta had stood against Persia at Thermopylae. Now, Macedon claimed to be the new Sparta. That would make Alexander a great hero, like Sparta's legendary King Leonidas. Except, of course, that unlike Leonidas, who died at Thermopylae, Alexander planned to live. Unlike Leonidas, Alexander would have another chance to prove himself in battle against the Persians. We'll turn to that in the next episode. For now, thanks again for listening today, and I look forward to our next conversation on Antiquitas. Please like us on iTunes, and if you are so moved, write a review.
Theme music by Lush Life.